Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
So welcome back, everybody, to section two of our interview today with Billy Matthews, where we're talking about diversion, diversion investigators, tactical diversion squads, and everything DEA. And occasionally, if you listen to episode one, I go off on a tangent and talk about stuff that has absolutely nothing to do with today's topic, but can't help myself. And luckily, Billy and I see eye to eye on pretty much everything. So
we do.
He's always right in with me. But in our first episode, Billy, you were telling us about your son being in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and your son born down there with a heart issue. So let's get back into that.
And you know, you had asked earlier, like, what brought me into DEA? And then we talked about that. But what kept me in DEA and kind of changed and shifted was my kiddo. My son was born in Sao Paulo with a major, major heart problem. You know, he had a valve that didn't quite grow, and he ultimately needed open heart surgery in Sao Paulo, and two open heart surgeries in Sao Paulo. And he'd be saddled with metallic valve and a pacemaker and blood thinner medications for the rest of his life. And you always appreciate the medical sector, especially us, right, Murph? I mean, There's been times when we're out on warrants and we needed an ambulance rig near, or God forbid, one of our guys got hurt and they would have to roll to the hospital. So we already had that built-in appreciation because we worked with them. When you find yourself in a foreign country, you know, you're meeting doctors and nurses and they're all speaking Brazilian Portuguese, and you have a son that, you know, is in desperate need of medical care, you appreciate those individuals way more than you ever thought you would or could. And this is where you start really paying attention, because Brazilian Portuguese was not my native tongue. And you start listening and you watch the nurses and you watch the doctors and you watch the way they administer controlled substances or in drugs. And so I really appreciated them, but I also started paying extra close attention during this point in time. This was a shift for me. And I started really getting involved more in related to diversion, and partial in part because of what I told you, coupled with the Paula Rue case happened to end up in our laps down in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And we would work that case in Rio de Janeiro for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But After I had left Brazil, I would be transferred to the Dallas Field Division. I keep saying missing famous people, but Dan Salter was my SAC.
Oh, good guy.
Yes. And he allowed and afforded me the opportunity to serve in the tactical diversion squad. So I was transferred to Dallas underneath a medical hardship because of the situation. And I couldn't think of a better logic or reason to go other than just that. And so I'd end up with a TDS group, and I had all the individuals that we talked about. We had the DIs and the state and local officers and other DEA agents, and we were charged with, overseeing cases related to DEA registrants. And we talked about what those, individuals look like. But I will tell you, now in my head, I was focused in on more diversion than anything else. I actually felt like accomplished in targeting cartels up and down this hemisphere. And diversion was my focus at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And we do some great cases against doctors.
When you mentioned that Paul LaRue case, What was he into as far as that would bring diversion's attention to him?
He was into women. He was down in Brazil. I know Cedric talked about what he was involved with as it relates to diversion, but he came to Sao Paulo not to further his enterprise or his investigation. He was in a hodgepodge of other criminal activities, not just matters related to, pharmaceuticals, but he was also wanting to impregnate as many Brazilian women as he humanly possibly could to avoid extradition. And that was his goal, along with other illicit crimes. And we worked very, very closely with the Brazilian federal police. And we were able to successfully monitor him in Rio de Janeiro for about 70 some days. It was a long day. I mean, there were long days, poor us in Rio. But yeah, that's That's it. That's about it during that time. And a lot of stuff he was doing was via the internet.
All right. Walk me through his reasoning here for siring so many children in Brazil. How would that prevent his extradition?
Well, he believed that if he was to father children in Brazil, that if and stay and subsequently stay in the country of Brazil, that he can now avoid extradition if the United States come after him. He knew that the United States was already looking at him by the time that he would come across our plate down in Sao Paulo.
Does he have a leg to stand on, or is he a dumbass like I think he is?
Oh, no. No. So he would have eventually, in my mind, he would have been, if he had done all this successfully and stayed down there, he eventually would have been extradited, I believe, but he would have caused a lot of agita and administrative paperwork because of the laws at the time. So did he have a leg to stand on? Sure. Do I think we would eventually got him out? Yes. Would it taken it a while? Sure.
Yeah. And again, for those of you who want to hear the other interview we did with Tommy Cedric, retired DEA, it's episode 37 here on Game of Crime. So it's a very interesting case. I read the book. It was talked to Rob Zaharyshevitz about it. A lot of interesting things. Worldwide international investigation. Holy cow.
Yes, absolutely. That guy was into everything bad, for sure.
Now, as a tactical diversion squad supervisor, can you tell us a little bit about one or two of the cases that you worked with down there in Dallas?
Absolutely. I would like to think that the one thing that I brought to that group as being a supervisor was to help the group target the pill mills in North Texas. And pill mills at that point in time were all the rage. And there was a lot in Houston. Florida was definitely known. No shocker there, because you're in Florida, you would know this, but they were definitely known for pill mills. But North Texas, they were starting to really ramp up in around the time I was there, from 2013 to 2016. And the pill mill cases, I brought forth like the extra tool of wiretaps, electronic intercepts. And that won't surprise you at all, just because of the conversation so far. But we had some awesome DIs, diversion investigators and agents, and we had some great leads, and we had some undercovers, and we had some confidential informants. And so we had quickly identified pill mills that were operating in North Texas, and they had a scheme going on. The street thugs or gangbangers or the gangsters, they were actually using the homeless, Murph, and they were saying, hey, how would you like $35? And all you have to do is go into this, well, it was a pill mill, but they would say a doctor's office, and get a prescription for us. And if you're homeless, what do you think they said?
Mm-hmm.
Of course. So these gangbangers would load up their cars with homeless, and then they would go to these pill mills, in which the pill mills were being run by, well, they were owned by criminals. The doctors that were in on the schemes were criminals, mm-hmm, and acting in a criminal manner. The nurses and nurse practitioners also acting in a criminal manner. The mm-hmm pharmacies, there were pharmacies involved in the conspiracy. And so the pharmacies, well, they would fill the prescriptions. So the gangbangers would come in with cash and a car full of homeless, and then they would run them through the pill mill, get the prescription, come back out to the car. Then the gangbangers would be like, well, congratulations, here's your $35. Let me have that prescription. And then they would turn to the homeless and say, well, how would you like another $35? And what do you think the homeless would say?
Let me think about it.
Yeah. What do I have to do? Well, we've identified certain pharmacies, and we're going to take you to the pharmacy, and you're going to go fill them. And you would go get your Oxy 30s, 120 of them, or, you know, 90 of them. And you will give me the Oxy. And at that point in time, I'll give you another $35. Well, Steve, these pill mills were running through 120 of these homeless people and or other gang members or whoever they could find to fill their cars. They were doing this, and they were done by noon.
Wow.
I mean, they were setting up at, you know, 4 a.m, 5 a.m, like your doctor's office would, right?
Mine.
And then they would have security details wanding everybody, you know, because a customer today ended up being a thief later. We were just moments away from sending in our undercover one time, and there were shots fired inside of the pill mill, because the customers from the, you know, week prior knew where all this money was, because they were run through the pill mill, and they went to go rob the place.
Wow.
And it was scary. And it was also scary. Like, we would run 18 I think we ran like one, our top day, we would run 18 undercovers through one pill mill in one day.
Holy cow.
No, Murph, we had, I mean, I remember BPD, Arlington PD, Grand Perry, obviously DEA. There was so much presence on this one particular day. There were like SWAT teams in local hotel rooms. I mean, we had every undercover known to man to try to build these cases against the DEA registrant. And wow. So that was one case that went on for a while. We would wrap up, and we did not target the homeless. We targeted the gangbangers, the pharmacists, the doctors. We had the pharmacists on the line talking about the conspiracy. We had them facilitating on the line about what they're going to do, how many people they're going to pick up, how many people they can handle in one day, how much oxy they were going to have, so on and so forth. So when you couple undercover CIs, good solid police work with wires and everything else, I really believe we got over 70 people in several pill mills would be knocked down. And we even used the DPD fire department, now that I think about it. And we arrested an Uber driver. Yeah, so they refused to open up their safes, and we may or may not have asked DPD, or excuse me, the Dallas Fire Department or somebody to use their saw, and we would seize stuff. Yeah, we would absolutely seize stuff. That was good. The other case that, you know,
right, before you go on the next one, just quickly tell our listeners what a pill mill is.
Oh, so a pill mill can be have the appearance of a doctor's office, a legitimate doctor's office. It's where you do have DEA registrants that do have a DEA registration number that do operate underneath the quote unquote, the position of trust that we talked about. And these individuals would violate that circle of trust. And they would have people come in, citizens come in that were part of a scheme, and they would come in and go through a physical with the doctor or the nurse practitioner, somebody that's authorized to provide them ultimately with the prescription for controlled substances. In this case, hydrocodone and oxycodone. And by the way, it's October. Do you know it was 10 years ago this month that hydrocodone was rescheduled to be a Schedule 2 versus a 3? Little lone fun fact. Yeah, just weird stuff. But in this case back then was oxy and hydro. And so the doctors would see this quote unquote patient, really just an individual, you know, masquerading as a patient. And they would ultimately receive a prescription. Now, the physical in the cases I'm mentioning, they would last like a minute to 2 minutes.
Yeah.
It was really just the doctors having paperwork in case the DEA or maybe the Board of Pharmacy or another law enforcement entity would come in, so they can present and show something. But the pill mill, there's no pills actually walking out the door necessarily. That comes later because the doctors and the registrants here at this facility, they're in cahoots with a pharmacist, a pharmacy. And it's when those two items, those two facilities come together, although they might be miles apart from one another, that's your pill mill. Because the pills come rushing out of the pharmacy. And in this case, they were ultimately turned over to the gangbangers, and now they're serving those up. Gosh, you might get, at that time, $30 for a 30-milligram pill of oxy out on the street or more. And if you were getting 120 of them in a bottle and you ran through successfully 10 to 15 people per day, and you did that 5 to 6 days a week, you could see how you're polluting the community. How these practitioners violated their oath to do no harm. And that's what a pill mill is. I mean, that's really what it is.
Yes. In a nutshell, they're bringing these people in to get prescriptions for pain medications, and then they turn them over and they go to a rogue pharmacy and get them filled.
Yeah. And really, ultimately, in the pill mills in which I'm making reference to, nobody was suffering from pain.
Yeah.
It's all a farce.
Yeah.
Yes.
One question, did you see out-of-state tags coming into those pharmacies or those doctor's offices?
Yes. Back then, we did see out-of-state tags, and we would see people drive hundreds and hundreds of miles to these pill mills. And it's funny because think about how many pharmacies you pass every day when you just go to the grocery store.
Yeah.
Why would you travel hundreds of miles to go to these pill mills? I mean, so there were red flags all over the place at this point in time.
And in fact, my pharmacy is my grocery store.
There you go. And I'm sure you travel. I'm sure you travel 300 to 400 miles every day to go to their grocery store.
Yeah, or 1 mile.
Yeah, or one. Yeah, yeah.
That's what it's all about, convenience, right?
Yeah, and I'll tell you the other pill mill that I saw the other case. Now that you brought it up, was it was operating. The doctor was an affiliate of a hospital, and the hospital basically were used as it, the hospital was used as an unwitting.
Okay, so we got a good understanding of what a pill mill is, but I think you got another case to talk about, right?
I do. This one was when a doctor, a DEA registrant in the form of a doctor, was operating a pill mill in McKinney, Texas. He was operating a pill mill in McKinney, Texas, it was in the backside of a hospital, and he was an affiliate to that hospital. You know, I forgot to mention before, you know, under Title 21, Steve, you know, there is an exception for people to handle controlled substances. You have to be a DEA registrant, mm-hmm. a manufacturer, a distributor. We talked about that, or an individual that is authorized to administer a controlled substance. And without the DEA registration number or being a DEA registrant, you are in fact a drug dealer.
Yep.
And you could be charged, even though you're a registrant, you know, like a drug dealer, underneath the exact same Title 21 charges, like A41s, for example. And so this particular doctor that was operating McKinney was operating a pill mill, just like the one I described to you earlier, running people in and out of the hospital to get prescription and going ahead and filling those at pharmacies that were conspiring. Now, some of the pharmacies might have been unwitting, but there were several that were obviously conspiring. And right. That's your pill mill. The interesting thing about this pill mill, for me personally, was it was in close proximity to a school zone, that of my daughter. And I was shocked. I was shocked to head to work, to go 35 miles away to, this is going back then, down to Dallas, only to turn around and get the team to come back to surveil a pill mill in the close proximity of that of my daughter. And Steve, could you imagine the unscrupulous characters that, you know, are seeking hydro and oxy so that they can poison our streets? And this was coming out of the backside of a hospital. So this particular doctor, ultimately, the case has been adjudicated and he got 10 years, whereas some of the other doctors I'm alluding to got more than that. A couple of them that we worked during this time, they ended up getting 20 plus.
Yeah. And that's, you know, 10 years is not enough in my book. I know I'm not a dove when it comes to this. I'm pretty much a hawk.
Yeah, me too.
The thing that kind of really ticks you off about that is we all know doctors make good money to start with, right? Yeah. I mean, they earn it. My oldest son is an orthopedic surgeon.
Yeah.
And I know what he went through with med school and how he has to keep up with changes and new drugs coming out. You just got to keep up with the new technology, new devices that you can use. He does spinal surgery on children. Can't think of a more noble profession to be in, to be quite honest
Agreed.
With you. But, and I also know how much money he makes. I've got a good idea, I guess I should say. And this is nothing more than pure greed.
100%.
On the part of somebody who's already making more than, what, 90% of the country?
100%. That's exactly right. It's all greed. It's all about money. And that's it.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the Hippocratic Oath. That's in direct violation of that.
Of course. They're poisoning the very same community that they swore to protect and serve.
That's right.
To keep healthy.
That's right. And you and I took an oath. And we haven't violated our oath.
Correct.
It's just, it's very frustrating. I mean, the vast majority, and this is just like police officers. One bad police officer goes bad, we all look bad. One doctor goes bad, we think they're all bad. And that's not what this is all about. We understand this is a very small minority of physicians out there, that's a very honorable profession that, thank God that he's given you the talent to do that, because I don't have that talent.
Oh, listen. Part of the reason why I told you the story of my son, I never wanted anyone to think that we're talking about big swaths of DEA registrants running off the reservation and going crazy like we just described.
Mm-hmm.
It's precisely what you just described. It's a minute amount of individuals, but when they go bad, they know how to do it. They go bad.
Yeah.
And so I have the utmost respect for the healthcare and, you know, and all the DEA registrants in our nation. But unfortunately, you know, you do have what, as my parents used to say, a few bad apples, and that could spoil the bunch. And
it does.
That's it.
It does. And you'd mentioned earlier, because I want to ask about your son. He's 13 now, so it sounds like surgeries are working okay for him for his heart problem.
Yes, but when he was, and this just drives home the point that how much I love the healthcare sector. In 2 weeks, he's going back for his open heart surgery to replace that little metallic valve that didn't grow with him when he had it put in 13 years ago. And so, you know, right now it's, you know, even in retirement, everything that I do right now is for love of to protect and serve as much as I can in my retirement, but to also help out is wherever I can protect that supply chain to help keep, you know, people on the straight and narrow and to stop and thwart diversion of drugs. I do that in my retirement now.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. We'll talk about that here a little bit more towards the end, but ladies and gentlemen, just another perfect example about, I've got this little corny saying, Billy, just because we retire doesn't mean that our oaths ever expired. You're doing what you can to still serve and protect. I sit on my butt behind a camera here and try to do my little thing. And it's just, it's part of our oath. I tell people when the people contact me and say, hey, I saw Narcos or read your book, I've seen your podcast, whatever it might be, you've inspired me to go in law enforcement. What advice do you have? The first thing you have to understand is this is not a 9-to-5 Monday through Friday job. This is a lifestyle.
Yeah.
If you're going to do the job right, and if you're not going to do it right, don't come in. Go do something else. You get around, go be a fireman. And fireman, you know, I love you. Just got to pick on you at every opportunity we get.
Absolutely.
But, so anyway, so those were good examples of what a tactical diversion squad does. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate you sharing those stories with us. Now, next you go on into, you go to Washington next. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you go to training?
Initially for a year, I went to, you know, to the FAST teams and I oversaw as an administrator, not an operator, the FAST teams. And then I would move and I picked up some skills there on personal recovery, especially. And then I would move over to the academy for sure.
And the FAST teams, for those who aren't familiar with that term, can you explain what the FAST teams, what that stands for and what they do or did?
Yeah, the forward advisory support teams. And they would be the DEA operators. They were, for lack of a better term, in my mind, they were like the Navy SEALs for DEA. They were just that those teams and what they did during wartime and how they served overseas and the sacrifices they made were tremendous. I can't speak higher enough. What they did for our country was amazing. And I have a lot of respect for them. And the program has the cessation. I actually saw the cessation of the program begrudgingly, but it happened. And what they did over in Afghanistan, amazing.
Yeah, we had Joe Pierce-Sante on here. Oh, episode 22. Who was shot in the head during a deployment in Afghanistan, survived. He's blind, but that man has never, you talk about a motivational person.
Yeah.
He has never given up.
Never.
I mean, not only what he, you know, he worked out his career without sight. He is a professional bodybuilder. He's earned his lifetime world license in his age group. It's just amazing the things that Joe does. So if you haven't heard that episode, go back to episode 22. But that's just an example of the studs that we have at DEA that going over doing God's work.
The studs is the right way. You know, Joe is everything that you just said. And I even got to meet a nurse that kept him stable. He was an Air Force nurse that kept him stable before he got medical treatment. And he's a friend of mine. And what Joe persevered and what he went through and what he survived. I mean, man, talk about the human spirit and what you can do when you put your mind to it. Yeah. Truly motivating. 100%.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. That's an American patriot and hero right there.
100%.
So, and sorry to get off on a tangent there, but I think they ended the FAST teams after I was already gone, after I'd already retired. Why did they end that program?
Oh, I think that's a $1 million question. I really, even now, years later, I went to the FAST teams to be part of something that I remember going there thinking I was already part of the dark side. I wanted to go to the FAST teams because I wanted to be part of something special, something different. And I wanted to just broaden my horizons and be part of something as fabulous as that. It was awesome. But when I got there, shortly after my arrival, I felt like I was, you remember the storm clouds that you saw in Charlie Brown, like the black cloud coming in?
Yeah.
I thought I was their black cloud. I had no idea that they were going to shut down this program, you know, months after I decided to report. It was a huge disappointment. I think maybe it's partial in part because the war was, you know, going down. We had changing of administration. You know, everybody was, Murph, even years later, it's truly unclear to me precisely why. I mean, I was there when the decision was made, and that was it. Like, then I had to be, quote unquote, the good soldier and help, you know, see it go to end. And it was begrudgingly. We were able to help out a lot of the personal, we established our personal recovery teams within DEA, help people get off the X in the time of need. And those teams help out even now today with other three-letter agencies around the world, especially if they have USCs, United States citizens or government officials, and if they're in trouble, they train our DEA people how to properly work and to keep them to work overseas and to keep safe and their families safe overseas. So a lot of the forward momentum that we have in the personal recovery programs with DEA stem from FAST. Yeah. That's the phoenix of FAST. You know, that's absolutely. So I don't have a good answer for you, Murph. I'm sorry. I don't.
I think it's, I'm going to guess it has something to do with politics. You know, the changing of the guard in Washington and had, this might have been before your time, but we had Snowcap where we were sending guys down. And then we had Operation Bat down in the Bahamas, Turks and Caicos. I'm not sure if that's still going, but all these good operations. And then FAST, taking the fight to the enemy. That's one of the things that is one of DEA's fortes.
Yeah.
Where we have agents stationed all around the world. In fact, DEA has the largest federal law enforcement footprint outside the United States of any other law enforcement agency.
Yep, we sure do.
And that's one of the things that makes DEA so successful. And then when I hear that, you know, headquarters is, or OIG is doing a review to see if, you know, our foreign participation is productive, I don't know what the results of those investigations are, but I certainly hope they see the light and realize the significance of that. That's our bread and butter, but just a colloquial saying type thing. It's one of the things that makes DEA so successful. So
agreed.
Anyway, so now you're in FAST.
Yep.
So that was part of training while you were doing that.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. So the program would go away and then we were at a secret offsite. I like saying that. It sounds cool.
Yeah.
But it was in close proximity to Quantico. So I was offered a position to come over to Quantico. And that's how I ended up at training. Just timing, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Had you ever wanted to go to training?
I had a desire to go to training. I didn't think I was going to go to training when I did. I thought it would be a little bit later in my career, but it made sense. It was logistical. I didn't have to move. And I was asked by somebody that I respect very, very much to come over. And that was Mr. Tarundolo. And so I had to go somewhere and it just made sense. And so I went over there.
Mm-hmm. Is that when Greg Tarundolo was chief of staff?
No.
For the administrator?
He was the SAC.
Training. That's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When I got promoted up to the SES ranks, I wanted to take over training. And I think they realized that my IQ might not have been high enough to go in that environment.
I think you would have had a lot of fun. I think it would have been great.
We had a good time, I'm telling you.
Absolutely.
But so do you go in as a GS-14 or a 15?
No, so now I go in. I was already a GS-15 at FAST, promoted out of the Dallas group. I went to FAST as a 15. I go to training as a 15. They would let me keep personal recovery because I already developed that a little bit of that experience. I was really all about protecting that program as much as I humanly possibly can because of the need and to protect some of the legacy as much as I could at FAST. That was my intent.
Mm-hmm.
But they gave me all things diversion as well as underneath my portfolio of things to help out with, along with all things intelligence, DEA intel. And all of it kind of made sense to me with my diversion background, my SOD intelligence background, and obviously the limited amount of time I spent with FAST with personnel recovery and my desire to keep that program up and running. Yeah.
Now, and so you took those programs, especially diversion, and you revamped their training program. Is that correct?
I did. So every block of instruction, the diversion of program at the Office of Training It's a 12-week program, unlike, you know, ours, that the agent program that might be 16 or 17 weeks, which fluctuates. It's, mm-hmm. The DI program might go 11 or 12 weeks. It all depends.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
And so they have blocks of instruction, and every block of instruction would go through my fingertips along with the instructor's fingertips and along with the academy's protocols. And some stellar individuals, that oversaw it was Dr. John Neese. Pleasure to work with him. And he would help shepherd all these blocks of instruction that would be afforded to the students. And the students would have to go through those blocks of instructions during 12 weeks before they would graduate across the stage. But we also... the way I revamped it, I would help out with that already established program. But I stood up a second group. There was the regulatory side, the civilian side, the teaching of the new student side. But then we stood up another group. And this group targeted DEA registrants criminally. How to do a criminal case against a DEA registrant. And so that is the group that I stood up and developed and helped develop many courses and picked really spectacular folks to train not only new students or individuals that are going through the diversion mm-hmm. class, but already existing diversion investigators across the country. And we would not only train them, Steve, the new ones, the new minds and the old minds and everything in between, but we trained hundreds of United States prosecutors across our glorious nation to help them understand and formulate a strategy to help charge these individuals and develop cases against the registrants or their executives or, well, the enterprise. You remember, DEA registrants take many different shapes and sizes, and you mm-hmm. might be part of a larger corporation or enterprise that works throughout the United States. And so once you went through these courses, would have, if you didn't already have a baseline, you sure would have that. But by the time you finish the courses and go through the training, you would feel comfortable in pushing criminal charges against registrants across the nation if they were deserving of it. Of course, we mentioned, and I'll just say it again, small group of people that went off the reservation, but they needed this. And from there, we actually developed a whole section in Hogan's Alley that I understand that got stood up, Murph, after my departure, which is
nice.
Cool.
Nice. Yeah. The thing I love about that training, because I read up on this before you came on for this interview, is that you had agents and prosecutors and diversion investigators working together.
Yeah.
Which is, you need that experience from both sides because, we think we're in charge of everything as agents, and we know everything there is to know about working a criminal investigation, or at least we think so.
We're type A.
Yeah. But then you got your prosecutors. They're the ones that have to stand in front of a judge and a jury and present everything. And so the fact that you've got the two different groups together.
Yes.
And you bring in the expertise of the diversion investigators to help the agents along. It's kind of like an intelligence analyst. I kind of say they're the brains and the agents are the brawn a lot of times. Mm-hmm. Not always, but a lot of times it's like that. And if you can find a good team that works together like that, that's very forward thinking, in my opinion, that you did get everybody together. The investigators the attorneys can tell you, if, especially, did you do mock cases during the training?
Yes.
Yeah. So you're actually employing investigative means to reach whatever the goal is you're trying to reach, and then your prosecutors can see what it is you're trying to do, but then they can tell you, hey, that's illegal, or that's not sufficient, or you need to do a little bit more, or that's not necessary. But everybody gets an understanding of each other. It facilitates the eventual prosecution of criminals, and that's what this is all about.
And it was such to develop those teams that you're talking about. We would get prosecutors that successfully prosecuted these types of cases, which, they're not hard, but they weren't common. And so we would have other prosecutors join in on the instruction and help foster that relationship to to bridge that lingo, that gap, that culture between the prosecutors and the investigators so that it would come together like that of peanut butter and jelly so that these cases would go forward. And we did it in what I call a safe place, meaning, hey, listen, ask all the stupid questions you want to ask. But at the end of the day, these people are hurting us. They're hurting our community. To go back to, you know, the very beginning of our conversation, people need to be held accountable. They do.
Yep.
And so this is the way we did it. We fostered all of that.
For sure.
I love what you're saying there. And again, to go off on just a little tangent here.
Sure.
Tangent. I love that.
It's amazing how we're becoming so, I guess one word is permissive.
Yeah.
I guess you could say a kinder, gentler nation. We've got well-known people who want to come in and help convicted criminals get out of jail early. And don't take me wrong, the last thing, and I think you'll agree to this. In fact, I know you will. The last thing we want to do is put an innocent person in prison.
Of course.
But
right.
I'm doing research on a couple of things now for other episodes and some Patreon stuff. And I'm looking at the Menendez brothers.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how that works out. But and even the articles I'm reading, there's no question they murdered their parents.
Sure.
But I guess they're looking at the extenuating circumstances that surrounded that. There's accusations that maybe the government side withheld evidence that would have supported maybe not a life term in prison. I don't know. It's interesting to see how that's going to work out. But you see some of the people that are supporting that, and I'm thinking, what the hell have you ever done in life other than impose yourself in a situation where you get publicity? And you know what? If you're wrong, nothing happens to you, but the poor people that you've given hope to, if they don't get out, you've dashed their hope. I mean, you never want to lose hope, even for a prisoner. You don't want to lose hope in prison. So, and again, that's the side tangent. So you'll hear me bitch about that on Patreon and maybe some other episodes that come along here.
I'll be watching.
Now, the Intel program also, when I got promoted to SES, Michelle was the DE administrator at the time, Michelle Linhart. And she said, you got to love Michelle. She gave me an option where I could go. And, or maybe she's just being nice and knew where she's going to put me. But she put me under from operations side to the Intel side.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her, I said, Michelle, I think there's been a mistake here because the words Murphy and Intel don't go together. I'm an ops guy.
Right.
But it actually put me in the Office of Special Intelligence, which directly supported the dark side. I said, you were already gone by that time. But,
right.
And then from there, I moved over to the OSDEF Fusion Center. And that's where I finished out my career. But having that intelligence background, did you have to revamp the Intel program at training or augment it? Or was it running well and you just let it go with that?
No. I didn't have to make much changes. I did not make many changes there at the time, believe it or not. And I haven't kept up with it, but we were struggling on putting together a full class. And that was concerning to me so that we could keep up with what I call the tyranny of turnover. During my time in overseeing the Intel program, that was my focus. I thought the blocks of instruction were solid. We inserted a couple more things that were relevant trends. You know, what was happening, you know, we talked about trends. We updated some of the materials and we talked a little bit more about the cartels and what they were doing at that point in time, just to keep relevant and change the blocks of instruction around ever so slightly. But really, those blocks were solid. My focus at that time for Intel was to increase the amount of individuals that were going through the class to get them to help HR and DEA pick the right and correct people to be, as one of my colleagues says, to be that of a filter versus that of a pump. And getting the right people in and the right amount of people in for a class. But I thought the blocks of instruction were solid.
Now, as I was in part of the Intel division, when they would have classes graduate from the academy, I'd go to their graduations. Mm-hmm. And I've got to tell you, those are impressive people. The amount of PhDs and master's degrees and what's a class, 30 Intel analysts?
30 to 50, depending. Yes.
It was awe-inspiring. I felt like an idiot sitting there amongst them. And then you get to work with some of them. They're just fantastic people.
And some of the classes that I remember, we were hoping for 30, but we didn't reach those numbers just because of logistics. But not only did they have all the degrees, but I remember several of them that spoke so many different languages.
Mm-hmm.
It was tremendous. It was really impressive, like you were saying. Yeah,
yep. They were great.
It was. It was, you know, I know that they're having trouble filling the agent classes at the academy. They've started bringing Javier and I up a couple times a year to talk to the basic agent trainees. And and whatever, if there's a diversion class, Intel class, or even the TFO class, they'll bring them in as well, which for us is, I know it sounds corny, but it's like going home just to go back there. Not that I want to go back there and go through all that crap again, but I mean.
Well, they still have your Narcos poster in the conference room with your autocross on it.
Yeah, that's kind of strange, but I tell you what, I love it. It's one of the most, it's one of the events that we look most forward to going to every time we go back up there. Usually we have a hard time getting through the FBI security, even though they know we're coming. They make you wait out the gate there because you're DEA. It's the last time we pull up the gate and you're not on the list. And now they got to make phone calls. And this is after hours. So not everybody's available. And I tell you what, the little FBI police officer that was talking to us, extremely cocky. She might have been 5 feet tall, but I mean, just had an attitude that was out through the roof. And finally, she's like, "What are you going up here for?" So we're speaking to the trainees. "What's it about?" "Classified. Can't tell you."
Awesome.
That's nothing classified about what we're talking about.
No, we're going to the Golden Eagle to have a beer. Thanks.
It's a hoot. But also, you mentioned that you were in charge of international training. So can you just describe what it is DEA does on an international level?
Yeah. So there was a brief period of time that I ran the academy. And right before I was to retire, they afforded me the opportunity to oversee all things international training. And international training was made up of instructors, of several different groups of instructors. And the instructors would provide instruction to foreign nationals that were in support of, DEA's mission. Mm-hmm. And so one group would oversee the special investigative units that would train hand-selected individuals, foreign nationals that were in law enforcement, to come back to Quantico to serve there and train there with our DEA agents. And then they would go back out to their respective countries and work with our brethren abroad in doing, drug cases, to do what it is that we would do. There is another group, I call them the B team. They would provide training at the ILEAs, the International Law Enforcement Academies, sprinkled across the planet. And they would provide training to, again, law enforcement, foreign nationals, in a wide range of topics, anything from undercover to clan labs and everything in between, surveillance, how to handle informants, report writing, wiretapping, all of those skills would be passed on. There was a lab team, and they would go wherever it was needed to provide clandestine lab training. Maybe there was a lab abroad or there was a problem abroad, and maybe the country didn't have the resources, didn't have all the people brought up, to be high speed, low drag in that world of dealing with clan labs. And they were very, very specialized. And so they would go abroad. And then we would have, I call them the Charlie team. The Charlie team would just bounce around, and wherever a DEA agent felt that their foreign counterparts needed assistance in a particular category, they would fill the gap. They would bounce and they would be gone. Murph, there's some of these individuals that I would oversee this program for a while. And before I retired, I wouldn't see some of my instructors for, I bet you there's one or two that in the 3 years that I was running in and out overseeing, or however long it was, international training, I bet you only saw this one individual two or three times. They would constantly be on the road. They wouldn't have a home base. Some of my instructors, they had a man cave, and they would just pay the rent. They might stay in their apartment for 2-3 nights, and then they were off to another foreign country immediately.
Yeah.
They're gone.
Yeah. And where's what makes that important? First of all, with DEA's the large presence of agents and analysts that DEA has in the overseas environment, you're not there to train them when you go over to an overseas environment. You're going over there to work with them.
Yeah.
So you want them to have that training. But also the really important thing is you want those people vetted.
Yes.
To make sure you're not bringing criminals into the mix. I mean, that can always change. That's the gamble you take. I know DEA takes that very seriously.
Yes.
And then you look at the lab training. I mean, some of those chemicals, if you're producing meth, there's part of the process that if you inhale those fumes, you're dead.
Yes.
I mean, these are extremely toxic, extremely volatile. What is it? Red phosphorus. If air touches it, it explodes.
Sure. Red phosphorus is, one of the substances they put in the meth, if you can believe it.
And when you see all the nasty ass chemicals, the toxic chemicals that go into all these synthetic drugs and make no mistake about it, cocaine is not organic, okay?
Right.
You know
right.
that, but for everybody else, it's all synthetic. It's man-made. Is the coca leaf involved in the initial production? Yeah, but that's just a very minute part. So you look at these nasty chemicals, why would you ever want to put any of that stuff in your body?
And Murph, take a look what's going on now that's trending. All these chemicals that are being put into illicit fentanyl, where do you think they're coming from?
You and I know.
Right? Yeah. And so to train our colleagues and counterparts to survive these types of encounters and to work with us, and it does develop the rapport. And remember, we're in their house. And so we got to count on them to work with us. A lot of the training that I made mention of fosters those relationships of that of trust so that you can push the ball forward.
Absolutely. 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 That's one of the best programs that any agency has, in my opinion, is the FBI's National Academy program. Mm-hmm. That is, man, they have contacts all around the world and almost every city in the United States. It's amazing. That I know we used to have the Drug Unit Commander's Academy, which was, I think, an attempt at trying to do an NA. But
and just one last point. It's not only the troops, like the people that are doing the cases on the ground, Murph, that these international training teams have taught and instruct, it's also the heads of some of these countries. It's mm-hmm. the heads of state. I participated myself in leadership training in two countries that I can think of that in which we had their version of attorney generals present and their subordinates. And so you're meeting with heads of state, like heads of country, in fostering the relationship at that level. So if you really think about it, you're putting hardworking gumshoe kind of agents, you know, true detectives and investigators with their foreign counterparts equal to or greater than, but also the training teams would help bridge the gap on leadership. Yeah. So when you have to make gigantic, enormous political decisions, they too already have a comfortability, a familiarity with us. And those same heads and leaders, they would come to the graduations at Quantico. I mean, Murph, there are leaders that are talking to attorney generals, but also heads of military branches that they oversee literally, like, I don't even think I'm exaggerating, 100,000 troops in their country.
Wow.
I mean, these are the people that you're exposed to at the Office of Training during these times of training. I mean, talk about an honor and a privilege to have seen that, touched that, been part of that. It was so important, Murph. It really is.
It is. It is. And I was having a thought here as you were talking about that kind of going back on our discussion about our legislators and what they're trying to do, or hopefully even paying attention. It's amazing. It's amazing where their priorities are. And this is just a thought, and this would be a budget item. But if we're serious about tackling the overdose rate in the United States, you said 2 million registrants within diversion, the DEA diversion program.
Yeah.
And we've got 700, yes. roughly 700 investigators. If you had 7,000, that'd still not be enough.
Right.
But what if you did have the resources to really pursue that and stay on top of it? I mean, it's not that I ever want to get audited by the IRS. I'm kind of glad they don't have enough investigators in the IRS because I'm not that I'm doing anything illegal, but I just don't want the hassle. What if they would really take a strong stance and bring in several thousand diversion investigators? I don't know. It just had that thought fleeted through my mind.
It's not a bad thought, especially when you think of what you just said, 2 million versus that of 700.
It's comical.
I mean, yeah, they do a very good job. Diversion control at headquarters does an amazing job. There are some brilliant minds. You know, Tom is one of them, one of the heads of diversion. There are some brilliant minds there, but there's only 700 DIs.
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
It's a numbers game.
And I think some of the DIs are even dispersed overseas now, aren't they?
Yeah. So there's not if you become a diversion investigator, there is a chance that if you so choose that this is something you aspire to, yes, you can serve overseas. You can either be posted overseas or work investigations like the Paul LaRue case that had people traveling overseas for sure.
Interesting fact, because you mentioned about where chemicals come from. We know they're all coming from China. For the fentanyl and a lot of the methamphetamine chemicals. Javier and I were in Washington State speaking, I don't know, a month or so ago to the Swinomish Indian tribe, to the police, the chief of police there. was called together a police conference, and there's a ton of Indian tribes, small tribes throughout that part of Washington state. And they're right up next to the Canadian border. And one of the things I'd learned, I had not heard this, is that the Canadians in Vancouver and the west side of Canada, the Chinese are now shipping their chemicals into Canada. And the Mexican cartels are sending people up there to produce fentanyl and meth on the Canadian-U.S. border to infiltrate the United States from our northern border. I mean, that's always a possibility, but I'd never heard anybody say that. And in fact, the chief up there, Earl Cohen, by the time your episode comes out, he may have already been on here. But it's just amazing. They're not slowing down at all. So,
well, who better to smuggle anything across our borders other than the Mexican cartels? I mean, who's been doing it longer?
Exactly.
Right?
All right. So this has been, is there anything other involving diversion? Because I know I've gone off on a lot of tangents today, but that I've missed that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, if you like, I can tell you what it is that I'm doing now.
Absolutely.
In my volunteer work, as if I don't get into diversion enough, I am the Texas-based chapter president for the National Association for Drug Diversion Investigators.
Yeah, NADI.
NADI. And what a wonderful organization that provides a lot of great training. And they're a national organization. They have their national conference coming up right now, which I'll be speaking. But they put on training across the United States. The training will help find diverters, maybe a DEA registrant or a individual that works for a DEA registrant that has decided to go dark and divert and steal theft of controlled substances. That's their bailiwick. And in my, so that's what I do in my volunteer and my spare time right now. And for work, I instruct on all things related to that of diversion. And I run DEA, I call them DEA mock inspections because I'm retired and I don't even want to play a real agent anymore on TV. I am retired and I bounce across the United States doing mock inspections. And it won't surprise you and probably won't surprise your audience now after if they made it this far, that I focus my attention on the hospitals. They are just one of, of a category of those 2 million registrants that we talked about. And I focus on the hospitals to help them out as much as I humanly possibly can, not only in furtherance of NADI, and hopefully DEA feels the same way I do, DEA's mission, but also I want to create a safe, help them create to ensure that there's a safe place for people like my son. I need them in 2 weeks, and I want them to be at full strength and full capacity and not have to be struggling with somebody else that's infiltrated their ranks and they're suffering from addiction and they become a thief. I don't want that on the day of my son's surgery. And I think what it is that I do now, both in work and volunteer work, helps the hospital systems across the United States of America to thwart or stop. My goal is to stop drug diversion within hospitals.
That's a very aspiring goal. That's very motivational to hear. And again, you're still doing your job. You're probably getting paid a little bit better now, but that's upside, right?
That's the upside. Yes, absolutely.
There was, as most of the guests that come on here are, they don't like to promote themselves. You can tell most of our guests are very humble, but you've been recognized. I did a little research on you, and you've received quite a few awards throughout your career. Mm-hmm. A couple of them that I want to mention. I think the DEA Administrator's Award for Group Achievement, I got one of those in my... Well, that's actually a case that we did when I was an ASAC, Assistant Special Agent Charge there at SOD and OSA, the Mexico Central America section. You got two of those.
Yes, sir.
Wow. And where were you in and what were those? What was the focus?
The very first one I got was LAPD, when I was working with LAPD majors, and we were running a wire investigation I made mention of, and we were knocking off tractor trailer loads of dope in New York City and Newark, New Jersey, along with other places, but primarily those two. And hitting money loads, heading back. And so I got one for there, and I got another one for the dark side. So I wish I could tell you more about that.
Yeah, no. You received the award of honor from the International Narcotics Enforcement Officers Association.
That was for Project Reckoning. If you were to Google Project Reckoning, that's when I was an SOD staff coordinator at NOSA, your old section, the Mexico section. And we orchestrated, coordinated some of the best investigators this nation has, along with our, some of our foreign counterparts that I made reference to. And we had a worldwide takedown of Gulf Cartel and Zeta members on September 16th, 2008. 175 individuals of leadership from the Gulf and the Zetas were taken off in one day. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. I didn't know about that. I mean, I remember hearing about the operation, but I didn't know they had that huge takedown like that.
Yep. It was monstrous. Yep. In many different countries. Yeah. For sure.
Within the Department of Justice, we have the Organized Crime, Drug Enforcement Task Force, the OCDEF program. And was that the director's award or what was that award for?
That was the director's award.
Very nice. And that's just for what, showing up for work every day?
Just every day. Yeah.
Drinking
lots of coffee. I mean, I'm highly caffeinated right now for sure.
Oh, I always have.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so that one there was, that was also a cocaine case that we arrested lots of people, a lot of bad people, as you would say, doing bad things to good people.
Yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely. And then the Northern District of Texas Law Enforcement Commendation for a diversion investigation.
Yes, sir. That was for the pill mill operations cases that we were taking off and knocking down all those bad actors that were DEA registrants that went rogue. And we worked very closely with the Northern District of Texas on that. And I would say at that point in time, this was the largest drug diversion investigation against pill mills ever, for sure.
Wow. I remember the stories coming out of Florida. I didn't realize it was that prevalent in the Dallas area. I knew it was in Houston.
Yeah, so all roads led to Houston. I mean, Houston, it's, I guess, the bad people that do bad things to good people saw profit, and they pushed it north to Dallas. And that's what I think happened.
Greedy bastards.
Greedy bastards.
And then the DOJ Award for Intradepartmental Cooperation. That's a different one.
So that was another dark side award.
Okay. Enough said right there.
Enough said.
I swear, I just missed that program so much because it was so successful.
I know it.
Maybe someday the truth will come out about that.
Yeah. One can hope. It deserves it. The story deserves to be told.
Yeah.
It probably never will be. And that's okay, too.
Yeah, true. For our taxpayers, just know that you were getting your money's worth with the program. I'm telling you, you were.
Absolutely.
Have you ever given thought to writing a book?
Yeah, maybe. What do you think?
I think it'd be interesting. It's amazing how many people are writing books now.
I thought about it. I got to tell you, I'm just too busy. I'm just too active. Yeah.
That's what we were fortunate in that we had a ghostwriter. Some of the regular listeners have heard this before, but when I retired, I thought, well, I'll take a shot at writing a book about Escobar and all that. And I sat down one day, wife was still working, and I sat down for maybe 6 hours and just typing out my thoughts and everything and turned the computer off. A couple of days later, went back and read it, and I thought, what a bunch of crap.
Right?
And it sounded like a police report, you know? So we had a ghostwriter help us out there, which is the only reason the book was successful.
Well, then I'll say this, calling all ghostwriters, give me a call. We can talk.
There you go. Hey, Billy, if people want to find out more about you, I know I found you on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn, all at William J.C. Matthews. You can, if you got questions for Billy, because I know I didn't cover things that some of our listeners are going to have questions about, can they send you questions via LinkedIn or however?
Absolutely. I check LinkedIn. The other ones are just the Instagram and Facebook, quite frankly, is just me spot checking my kids. I'm very rarely on that. That's the way I spy on them. But LinkedIn... yeah, please reach out. Absolutely. Anytime. However I can help. And also, if you want to do something more formal with regards to Natty, you can reach me through Natty as well, whichever you would prefer.
There you go. And I meant to mention to you that several years ago before COVID, Javier and I got to be one of the keynotes at a national Natty conference. I think it was down in Savannah, Georgia is where it was. And typically, our regular listeners know I like T-shirt. I'm usually wearing a T-shirt. I wore DEA because you're retired DEA, but I'm really into free T-shirts. And I had a Natty T-shirt that was free, but it's a
They're good ones. I'm going to make sure Steve Natty sends you a Texas Natty shirt.
There you go. I will wear it proudly.
Awesome.
All right, bro. I can't tell you what an honor it is. I can't thank you enough for giving us your time to come on and educate us on not just diversion and within DEA, but the international training, the intelligence program, everything else that you participated in throughout your life. Being open and transparent to tell you about your son's medical program. We'll be praying for him for successful surgery and hopefully he never suffers from a continuing condition like that again. And for our regular listeners, now you folks, again, thank you so much for coming on here and continuing to support Game of Crimes. Listen to these heroes come on and give us their personal stories. They open up into their personal lives. You're not going to hear that on most other podcasts. So can't thank you enough for what you do to support the program. Just continue to support not only our heroes in law enforcement, but also in our military and all our first responders. God bless you. I look forward to seeing you in the next episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the morning. Until next then, stay safe. Well, unfortunately, that's it for this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Thank you folks so much for taking the time to see and hear some of the best true crime content you can find anywhere. None of this would be possible without your support. If you didn't know this already, Game of Crimes is now on YouTube. Just type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the YouTube search bar. You can send me your comments on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or to our email address, which is gameofcrimespodcast@gmail.com. Our website, it's gameofcrimespodcast.com. That's where you'll find all our episodes, books written by our guests, merchandise, and more. If you're looking for even more content, now go over to patreon.com/gameofcrimes and sign up. There you'll find several bonus episodes each month, ranging from serious and current topics to some silly and fun events. And you can even get early access to each week's interviews before they drop on YouTube or wherever you listen to your podcast. You can even subscribe for free and hear the first 5 minutes of each episode, and that's to help you decide if you'd like to spend some of your hard-earned cash to hear more. That's patreon.com/gameofcrimes. To all our guests here on Game of Crimes, it's an honor and a pleasure to have you on the show. I mean that sincerely. Thank you for your service to your communities, your countries, and for taking the time to tell us about your adventurous lives. May God bless and protect all the men and women in law enforcement, our military, and all of our first responders. And you know what? This goes for all of our listeners as well. Thank you for your continued support. And just one last thought here. It's okay for us to have different ideas and different opinions, but it doesn't mean we can't continue to be friends. All right. My final thank you. Thanks for joining me again to play the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. I'll see y'all next week.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.